Hi, I'm Marcia Altman, author of the Darcys and the Bingleys series, and I'm here to talk about Other Tales, Stories from the Ballad of Gregoire Darcy, which is a free ebook of short stories related to titular Ballad of Gregoire Darcy, which is the fourth book in the series. The book is available for free as an ebook in all digital formats as they currently exist. If you have one and you can't get it in that format, let me know. On my website, marshaaltman.com. It's also available on Amazon for 99 cents because for some reason Amazon won't go below 99 cents, won't allow me to set the price below that. So if you buy it on Amazon, I apologize for having to pay for it, but that's just the way the site works. And you're supporting me. It's not the end of the world. I'm just going to go ahead with this podcast for people who've read the stories and want to know how the collection came to be and what I have to say about the stories, because the whole thing in PDF format is 33 pages. So in the time it takes you to listen to this podcast, you could have read it. So if you want to go read it, just go to the website, get a copy, print it out, or put it on your computer, read it, come back, listen to this podcast. There's three stories. How this came about was I needed to do some publicity for the Ballad of Gregoire Darcy. And I realized that I had some short stories lying around. There's not actually a lot of supplementary material in the series, in the whole 10-book series, that didn't make it into the books. I mean, it's 10 books, it's over a million words. I pretty much did everything I wanted to do within the space of the books. I was so consumed with writing them, I didn't have a lot of time to be doing other writing. But occasionally, while I was writing the series, some scene would come into my head, and the scene wouldn't have any place in the series, or I couldn't work it in just because of when it occurred, or it was just too sidetracked. I would either write it and then to get it out of my head and forget about it, or I would write it and then I would give it to Brandy, she would edit it, and it would go up on my forums, which are still available. I also at one point was taking requests for very short stories for people who had questions and wanted to see scenes that they had imagined or were wondering about. So I collected what I could from that material. I couldn't use some stories I had written because they conflicted with the actual events of the series. And I couldn't use one because one of the scenes in it occurs at the same time as Book 7. Book 7 hasn't come out yet. I'll probably release it when in larger format when Book 7 comes out, maybe. But it's available on the forums of my website. Just follow the links to the forums. Sign up for an account, and then you'll have access to more material than is available if you don't have an account, because there's some stuff behind a lock. So I had two stories to work with, and I had the idea for a third one, which is the much longer one, which justifies the even putting out the ebook because the first two are very, very short. And I wrote that in May, I think, of this year, whereas the other ones have been written years before. And then put them together. It's pretty interesting, uninteresting experience, to be perfectly honest, in terms of how to publish an ebook. So the first story, Young Master Darcy. I don't know when it was written, I'm going to be honest. I finished this series in 2009 or something like that, and it was definitely written before that. I don't know when it was written. I didn't even post it anywhere. I just wrote it and then I forgot about it, but I kind of had it in my mind. When I showed it to Brandy when I was going to do a publish this story, she hadn't seen it before, so she sees everything that I write, so that was an indicator that I forgot about it at the time that I wrote it. I don't know what inspired me to write it, but so one of the main themes of this series, if you didn't notice from reading the series, and I'm just assuming you've read the series at this point, is not just family, but brothers. There's a lot of brothers in the series, and there's a lot of brothers-in-law, and there's a lot of parallels between different generations, and there's also kind of a running theme that if you support your family in its time of need, they will be there for you. And if you don't, then They'll not leave you out in the cold, but generally bad things will happen to you. So this is a story, I'm assuming you read it again, about Geoffrey Darcy, not the younger one who appears in the series, but Geoffrey Darcy, his namesake, who is Mr. Darcy's father, who died when Darcy was 22, which is 6 years before the events of Pride and Prejudice, and Darcy very much looked up to and still does, and sort of modeled his life after whom he thought his father was, not who his father actually was. As he learns in the second book, his father had at least two affairs that resulted in children. He doesn't know if his father had other affairs that didn't result in children. He just knows that his father also produced his half brothers George Wickham and Gregoire Belmont. So he's not thrilled to find that out. And Darcy and Wickham are pretty much complete opposites for the most part. I mean, really, if you want to be opposite, Gregoire and Wickham are opposites. Wickham is evil, Gregoire is good. Darcy's a little more in the middle there. He has different facets to his personality, but he's generally good. And this is reflected, this theme is reflected. Also, nature versus nurture is a very, very important element to this in the previous generation, which I pretty much invented. So this is my own work, because old Mr. Darcy is dead in Pride and Prejudice and is only referenced to. We don't know that much about him. Other than what Darcy thinks of him, we don't know that much about him. But for this story, from the point of view of Darcy's father, and again going to the theme of these two brothers in the previous generation, which Darcy doesn't know about. Well, he knows about them, but he doesn't know this particular story as it happened. He only has part of the information. There were two brothers, the Darcy brothers. Gregory, after whom Gregoire was named, the older brother who will inherit Pemberley, and Geoffrey, the younger brother, who will not, and that they both have their own positions in life. And obviously, Gregory has to inherit this great estate. He won't ever have to worry about money, but he has a tremendous amount of responsibility coming to him. And Geoffrey, the younger brother, doesn't have that responsibility. He's probably theoretically at this point in his life, the story takes place when he's about 15, could go off, he could join the military, he could move to the United States and get rich from a plantation or go to Jamaica or go to India. He has a lot of options. And Gregory really has none. And at this point in his life, Geoffrey, who the upstanding father of Fitzwilliam Darcy, is more of a Wickham than a Darcy in the sense that we think of Wickham and Darcy. He sleeps around with the maids. He's not very responsible. He shirks most of his duties. And the story encapsulates the moment in his life where he makes the most important decision he will ever make in his life, far more important than his wedding decision, actually, which is that because his older brother, Gregory, is sick with some kind of social anxiety disorder that they're not able to treat, which shows up in Darcy, but to a much lesser extent. He realizes that he's going to have to take over Gregory's position as the older brother because he proposes the plan to eliminate Gregory from the family tree, have him go off, live quietly on his own, and Geoffrey will assume all of the positions that his older brother was supposed to have. Which is a tremendous amount of responsibility that he really doesn't want. But he realizes that for his brother, he has to do this and he has to step up and be Mr. Darcy, the Mr. Darcy of Pemberley and Derbyshire that he will become when his father Henry dies. And he has to make a good marriage and he has to produce an heir and all of these responsibilities, which he previously had not expected to have, he is now going to have. Of his own choice. And it's just his moment to, step up to the challenge for the good of his brother. Which is, I think, the reason that I wrote it was I was comparing the generations And it kind of makes you wonder with Darcy and Wickham, had they known they were half brothers, and had Wickham been raised in an environment of more responsibility, being part of the Darcy family and the Darcy name, would he have turned out different? I mean, he would have turned out just different in some fashion, but would he have turned out, more on the side of good than evil? Would he have gone that other way if he had known who his father really was and had been in a position of responsibility to some extent, even as the younger brother who couldn't inherit because he was illegitimate? He still would have been a different person, and he might have had a much better relationship with Darcy had they been raised as brothers, obviously. So this is sort of these two generations you're supposed to reflect on from that one short story that's very, very short. And this, anyway, the second story, which is called The Tale of the Brothers Maddox, was actually a request. At some point in my forum, someone said, "We don't understand what's the deal with Brian and Daniel Maddox." Dr. Maddox, his first name is Daniel, because in the first book, when Brian is introduced, we don't know that much about him, but we know that he ruined the family and he's responsible for all of Dr. Maddox's woes. Darcy immediately suspects him of being up to something. He is up to something. Darcy's right. But Dr. Maddox eventually forgives him. It actually doesn't take him that long. It takes him about 12 hours to forgive him for the tremendous amount of trouble and damage he causes at Pemberley. And Daniel always believes in his older brother's inherent goodness, or he just loves his brother enough that he's willing to forgive him for, flaws in his character, which struck a lot of readers. A lot of readers didn't like Brian when he came in. They didn't like, it's not that they didn't like his character. It's that they didn't trust him. He wasn't a trustworthy guy. They thought he was an evil character. And then in the second book, people were really surprised. This is way back in like 2006 when I was posting it on fanfiction.net and I had daily comments from people on the chapters. People were genuinely surprised when Brian reappeared in what became The Plight of the Darcy Brothers. And tried to help Darcy and tried to reintegrate himself with the family, even though he understood that he kind of had to keep himself at a distance because of what he'd done at Pemberley, and not everybody was willing to forgive him, but Dr. Maddox totally was. And also, he had debts in England and couldn't really come back. And in the third book, he causes a lot of trouble, but it's not really his fault. He's would not have run off to Russia if he thought his brother was gonna wind up in prison as a result. He did it because it was the right thing to do at the time, and communications weren't good, and he had to do the correct thing, the brave thing for his wife. And his wife really kind of straightens him out. At that point, he's reformed a lot. He stopped gambling, but he's always kind of a wild card, and his wife, he sort of, his life becomes devoted to her at that point. And she's very straight and narrow, so he straightens out a lot. He becomes a successful businessman. By book four, he pretty much is. He's a reformed character. It's hard to say he's a reformed character. He was always inherently good. He just had character flaws of being a gambler and being a risk taker and not really being that great with money and being a lot more scandalous in some of his behavior than most of the other characters in the book, but pretty standard for a Regency character. He wasn't really evil in any sense, but just misguided and flawed. And a lot of people didn't really get him per se. They eventually came to love him, but at the beginning it was, they thought I was establishing him as a bad guy, but I really wasn't. I was waiting for him to turn into a good guy. So someone said, "Why is Dr. Maddox just so devoted to his older brother when his older brother is kind of a scumbag?" And so I did this story, which is about as you know, another mo some key moments in Brian's life leading up to his disappearance from England, right after the death of his father. Well, it's implied that before the death of his father, Brian Maddox is a wealthy single bachelor who's fairly young. He's about to go to college, I think, where he's going to drink and not do a lot of studying like most people of his social class. He's the his father's the younger son of an earl. He has enough money to be able to sort of cruise around, spend some time in college, come back to London, spend some time in London as a bachelor for probably 5 years, and then get married to somebody who's wealthy enough for him to marry, and then, live out his life however he wants to do that. And he has no mother. I don't remember whether their mother died in childbirth with Daniel or their mother died at some later point, but she's gone. She's been gone for a while. And then all of a sudden, his father dies. And he's not ready for the responsibility of running a household and raising his brother, who is very, very intelligent, but is eventually, they discover, going to go blind. And that's sort of hanging over them. And Brian is just not up to the task. It's not that he is a bad guy or that he's flawed. He's just not old enough to really know what to do. And he doesn't really get any guidance. He doesn't get any guidance from the larger family because they're completely disconnected from the Maddox family. This is something that is never explained at any point in the series, mostly because the characters in the series don't know and don't really have a method of finding out. But Stuart Maddox, after whom one of the grandchildren, I believe, is named, I think Frederick has a son named Stuart. Yeah, he has a son named Stuart. So, Daniel's grandchild is named Stuart. Stuart Maddox, which is spelled in the English way, not the s no, I'm wrong. I don't know which way it's spelled, English or Scottish, but Stuart Maddox, their father, his younger son of an earl, had some major falling out with his brother to the point where the family was no longer speaking to him at the time of the death and had no desire to reconnect with their nephews at the time of the death. There was a scene I didn't write, I never got around to writing, didn't really want to write, in which Brian attempts to get his father buried in the family plot for the Earl of Maddox, which, by the way, isn't a real earlship. I made it up for this story. And he doesn't succeed. The family has wants nothing to do with him. I think he eventually succeeds in getting the father buried in the family graveyard, but it's very, very tense. And they really don't want him there. And he never finds out what happened between the father and his older brother. And in the series, when we finally meet Dr. Maddox, we find in the second book, Play of the Darcy Brothers, Dr. Maddox runs into the current Earl of Maddox, who is the son of his uncle, so he's his cousin. And that Earl of Maddox is a perfectly amiable guy, also has no idea what happened between the two brothers. He doesn't know why he's been totally disconnected from his cousins, Daniel and Brian, and why his family wasn't there in their time of need. But it's not really polite at that point for Dr. Maddox to bring it up in a major way and say what happened there. He just doesn't know. It is a mystery of the previous generation. And I'm not going to solve that mystery now. I never actually wrote what it was. This also happens in Pride and Prejudice. There was some falling out. This is in the actual Austen novel. There was some falling out between Mr. Bennet and his younger brother, whose son is Mr. Collins. So, this is common in Regency England for names to be changed after falling out or taking a new position. So that's why Mr. Collins has a different name from Mr. Bennet, even though he's his fraternal uncle. Also, because if there had been two Mr. Bennets in the story, that would have been complicated for Austen, who doesn't use men's first names very often, because it's not appropriate. So she had to give him a different name. That's the actual reason why Mr. Collins has a different name. It's just a writing thing. She couldn't put in two Mr. Bennets. But And Mr. Collins makes reference to it very early in his opening letter. When he introduces himself, he says, "You don't really know me because my father and you, Mr. Bennett, had some falling out, which obviously I know about, but am not going to explain to the reader at any point." And that remains a mystery in Pride and Prejudice that is never solved, what exactly happened, because it's not that relevant to the main plot line. It's just something that happened that resulted in them having an estranged cousin who is still going to inherit the estate. So that was an unsolved mystery, and in the Maddox family, that remains an unsolved mystery, what happened with the father and his brother that resulted in these two brothers being totally isolated from their family, and Brian trying to step up to the task of taking care of his brother. At one point in the story, his brother almost dies of infection, and Brian really has no one to turn to for this, and he becomes kind of a drunk and a gambler as soon as he gets the chance because he is just so stressed out by this position of responsibility that he doesn't want and wasn't prepared for at all. And eventually he loses the entire family fortune to gambling because that was very, very common in this period. He actually, this story takes place before the actual Regency period. It takes place in the late 1700s, but it's still pretty much considered the quote-unquote Regency period. It's even though there wasn't officially a Regency at that time. This is a larger historical discussion of when would it's the Georgian period. It's the period of the later reign of George III. Dr. Maddox kind of knows. He was a kid for a lot of it, but he knows that his brother kind of gave up his life for like 10 years to take care of his brother, and he kind of understands that Brian really wasn't up to it and did his best, but eventually failed in a lot of respects, but didn't fail in the respect of being a good brother, except for, leaving Dr. Maddox kind of high and dry, but there was nothing he could do at that point. Brian had to flee because he had so many debtors that, he would have either gone to debtor's prison or he would have been killed by the people who he owed money. So he had to leave. He had no other choice. He definitely would have stayed if he could have. And Dr. Maddox understands that, and it's such a personal thing between the two of them that Dr. Maddox doesn't really ever explain it. I mean, he explains it pretty thoroughly in book one. But he doesn't explain it to the point that I've just explained it because it's private business between him and his brother. It happened a while ago. At the point in his life where Brian reappears, Dr. Maddox has married into money. Caroline Bingley has £15,000 or something like that. And he has a private practice that's about to thrive, is slowly growing. And he's not that worried about money anymore, and he just kind of considers it in the past. It's mistakes that Brian made in the past that Brian attempts to rectify. At first, he really can't, it's just too overwhelming. And Dr. Maddox would rather leave it in the past. It's his brother, it's his only blood relation, other than his cousin, whom he's not close to, and in book one, he doesn't know yet. And so is his brother. He loves him, he forgives him. Pretty much unconditionally, most of the time. And everyone else is kind of surprised by that because they don't know this deep connection between the brothers, and it really isn't Dr. Maddox's place to explain it, honestly. He doesn't really care to. It's just a private matter between him and his brother. And he's a more forgiving guy than, say, Darcy, who is known to hold grudges, even though he's a good character. It's not really black and white. He does hold grudges in Pride and Prejudice. It's kind of a major theme. And other characters have reason to be distrustful of Brian, but eventually come around when they realize the same thing that Dr. Maddox already knows, which is that Brian is inherently a good person, but can go astray when he is stressed out or tempted because he, at a time in his life when he should have been quietly maturing, he was instead assuming tremendous responsibility. Much like in the previous story with Gregory Darcy and Geoffrey Darcy. So these stories are very, very similar, obviously. That's just kind of the way it panned out. But I was actually pretty happy that it panned out that way. Because it's easier for readers to pick up on themes. And these are important themes for the whole series because Geoffrey Darcy the Younger, who's Fitzwilliam Darcy's son, doesn't have any brothers, but he's practically a brother to George Wickham the Younger, who is his cousin, and they have a close relationship as a result of them kind of not being raised together, but seeing each other a lot as children and as young adults, and knowing the connection between their fathers, and knowing that Geoffrey's father killed George's father, but feels really bad about it, and it wasn't self-defense. And it's a complex relationship, but it's an important relationship in their lives. George and Geoffrey are very, very close friends by the end of the series. They're pretty much always close friends, but Geoffrey really sticks his neck out for George in a couple cases, and George tries to do the same for Geoffrey. So that theme continues with the next generation, and this was my chance to show it in the previous generation and the quote-unquote current generation of adults. The third story is different. It's much longer because I had to put some length into it. I had to give some the people some, meat of the story. They had to get something that was more than like 3 pages long. I had this idea. It was incredibly hard for me to write because I was really off the bandwagon of writing Pride and Prejudice stuff. I had finished the series in like 2009 and really had only edited it since then. I haven't written anything in that time period since. I've done a lot of research, but I haven't written anything. I'm just kind of done. But I had to go write this story. I had the idea and I had a lot of reasons to do it, but I really didn't want to do it when it actually came down to it. And so I kind of put it off by just continuously reading about Georgie in London and Regency London and different ways to call London at that time to do research, which I ended up not using. Also, when I read a book that's just all research, most of the facts kind of fly out of my head. They're not usually at my fingertips when I'm writing. I'm sort of lost in the story itself, and then I have to go remember which book had which fact that I need to look up. I end up just doing a search on most of the material that I actually use, the historical material. I actually just ended up searching online and getting the information after I'd read like 10 books. I'm not kidding, there were like 10 of them that I wrote more to put off writing this story than anything else. And a lot of the pertinent information I had anyway. So, this story obviously is about the most important. It's the only one that takes place during the Ballad of Gregor Darcy. So, it is implied in the Ballad of Gregor Darcy that there are scenes going on in the side between Mugin and Georgie. And I know that some readers will not follow that plot line, they won't be interested in it, and they won't realize until book 8 how important that plot line is. Even though we don't see it most of the time, we know that it's going on. We know that it's slightly more important than people think it is. Especially when Mugin kind of gets kicked out of England, it implies that Georgie was succeeding in spending a lot of time with him under the guise of spending time with her childless aunt Noddy, which is what I call Brian's wife because I can't pronounce her actual name. It's a Slavic style name and I just can't reproduce the actual name in with my own tongue, which is sad because my family's from the Ukraine, and my family was Russian Jewry. I should be able to pronounce it, but I can't. So I wasn't raised speaking Yiddish or Ukrainian or Russian or anything. So she's not actually Russian; she's Romanian, but it's a similar guttural sound or non-guttural sound. I don't know what kind of sound it is. But under the guise of seeing her aunt, the Princess Noddy, whose husband Brian is now working with Bingley on some international trade, she spends a lot of time with Mugin. And Mugin's based, I know that people think Mugin's based on the Mugin from Samurai Champloo, and that is, legally, I cannot say that that is true. However, just take what I just said into account. Legally, I cannot say that that is true. But Mugin, as he developed in the series, is very, very much based on my sensei, with whom I had a relationship very similar, where I really, really respected him and kind of hinged on his every word. When I was a teenager, I thought he was amazingly cool. Then I went through a period where I thought that he was kind of lying to me about some of the crazy stories of things he'd done. Obviously, in the United States, he's not actually Japanese. I just call him sensei because that's what I was raised calling him, because he was my karate teacher for 9 years, and kendo teacher, and kenpo teacher, and SCA heavy metal armor teacher. And I still know him. He's now on Facebook, thank God, so I have some contact with him. Because otherwise, like for years, I just had his landline. And for my college years, I sort of thought he had been pulling my leg all these years. And then after college, I met some of his friends through the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronism, who had known him when he was young. And it turned out that like all of the crazy stories he told me were totally true, were confirmed by independent sources. And my relationship with him wasn't as deep as Mugen and Georgie, obviously. And also, I was a terrible student. I mean, I was really bad. I remain bad at martial arts. I never got good at karate. I barely made it to brown belt. I think that brown belt was more out of like guilt, I don't know, from his part for me never advancing. I was a green belt for like 8 years. And when I fight in heavy armor in the SCA, I am pretty terrible at that too. I really don't put the work into it that I should. And I just was never particularly good at martial arts. And I, had some sense that I never was going to be, but he was a really, really cool guy who I looked up to. And so a lot of Mugen is based on my sensei, who probably would not like me to use his real name at this point, so I just won't. But I gotta dedicate Bogate to him. Yeah, that's for sure. Bleed Nader, without oath, I should dedicate Bogate to him. But anyway, the relationship between Mugen and Georgie is the most important relationship in the series that is not based on blood or marriage. Definitely. I mean, there is no connection between them that is in the traditional way that people are connected in the series, which is blood or marriage. Either they get married, or they are related by blood, or they are related by somebody else's marriage in the family. Mugen and Georgie are not. They really have nothing to do with each other socially. But we eventually find out in book 8 that there's some quasi-mystical reason why they are connected, why their destinies are totally connected, but you can take that for what that's worth. I actually didn't write that plot line in at the very beginning. That plot line, the whole thing with her being a reincarnation of his previous teacher, was not written until book 8. So anything that you see in previous stories is not me th thinking ahead in the plot line, it's just coincidence. I am very happy about some of the coincidences that ended up happening, but that's just back writing. I didn't actually plan that out. In this story, obviously, I did know about that plot line coming up because I had written book 8 a while ago and I wrote this story recently. And at this point in his life, Mugen does know, but doesn't really want to fully acknowledge, definitely doesn't want to tell anybody, that Georgie is probably the reincarnation of his previous sensei. Though he wouldn't use the word sensei because his previous teacher was Tibetan by birth and Chinese by where he lived and how he spent most of his life. So, and sensei is a Japanese word, so Mugen definitely never called him sensei. But he has realized that. He's known it since like book 3. I haven't known it as a writer, but Mugen does know it. And he doesn't bring it up at any point. He doesn't really kind of want it to be. He has very mixed feelings about it. It's sort of reflective in the final conversation between him and Nadi about Georgie, though he's not outright saying it. I had envisioned him outright telling her and then decided against it. And just realize he wouldn't admit it at this stage because he doesn't really want to admit it to himself. He'd rather not have destiny calling at his door. He had this relationship. I don't remember whether this actually made it into book eight in that long segment where he talks about his time in China. I don't think I actually discussed that relationship we had with his sensei in terms of what Master Hugh actually told him, but I don't think it actually made it in. But Master Hugh did tell him, "I'm going to come back because you are the only one who's going to receive these teachings, and I'm going to come back to get them from you. And I'm not going to leave you alone. If you don't teach them to me, I'm just going to be really, really, really resilient, and I'm just going to find you wherever you go, and I'm going to bug you until you teach me everything you know." That is essentially what he tells Mugen before Mugen leaves and he dies. And this is actually pretty common in Tibetan culture in this reincarnation system that he had been born into, which Mugen didn't know about at the time, which is that basically at the end of their lives, really, really, really important lamas who have secret teachings will give it to their students and then say, "I'm going to be reborn in such and such a place. Go find me, and when I'm old enough, give me this teaching." The Dalai Lama has a series of teachings that is passed on via his teachers to each Dalai Lama. It's called the Golden Rosary. And the Karmapa also has a series of teachings, which his four heart sons, which are his most dedicated students, receive before he dies. And then the four heart sons give him the teachings. And for him, it's called the Diamond Rosary. The Karmapa is currently on the 17th iteration, and the Dalai Lama is currently on the 14th iteration. And the Panchen Lama also has the teachings, but the current Panchen Lama, I forget whether he's 11th or 12th, is currently hidden somewhere in China, so no one knows where he is, and that he hasn't been able to receive the teachings from his teachers because the Chinese government put him in jail when he was like 5. So this is actually a Tibetan tradition which Master Kyu attempts to tell Mugen about at this point in Mugen's life. He's about 16 or 17. He really doesn't want to hear it. And then he goes through his life kind of thinking he got off on it. And then he doesn't have that responsibility. And then he meets Georgie, who is this person who he would understand a lot anyway, because they're both kind of outsiders within their own cultures. And, kind of, not instantaneously, but during the course of book three, when we see some of their interactions, is when he realizes that, "Oh my God, I think this kid might be my master who finally found me, or I finally found him." And the way that I'm going to determine if it's really Hugh, which doesn't matter to me 100%, is if he bugs me just forever to teach him everything, then he's probably the same guy. It's probably him again. And that's exactly what Georgie does, is not because of any past life regulations, but because she's Georgie, she just says, "I want to know everything that you know. I'm going to bug you every moment that I have to teach me all these things that I will not need as a lady in Georgian England, but feel that I do need. You better teach me everything that you know." And Mugen's response to that is kind of, "Oh shit, I've heard this before from somebody else." But also, it kind of amuses him. And it's a very important emotional relationship, all Tibetan reincarnation mysticism aside, which I'm not necessarily endorsing as a belief system. I'm not a Buddhist. I do believe in reincarnation, but within the Jewish understanding of it, which is very different, that they both fill a need, this tremendous need in each other's lives, extremely platonic need, but they both have this, they're both outsiders within their own things. We don't really realize this to a full extent until book eight, when the grown Jeffrey and Georgie, now married and with kids, or with a kid, are able to see Mugen in Japan, where he has no status. He has like negative status. It is completely legal for most people to kill him. It's definitely legal for samurai or above to kill him and not give an explanation. Just say, I wanted to kill this guy, so I did. And it's pretty legal for anybody else to kill him and just give any reason, like he tried to rob me, or he was annoying me, or whatever. It's pretty much legal to kill him. He has no land, he has no family, he's of mixed race, he's half Japanese and half Islander, which means that his skin is a little darker than Japanese, full-blooded Japanese. And that's not something that the Europeans in the novels are able to tell, but it's something that the Japanese are just instantaneously able to tell, that he's not 100% Japanese. And he's an ex-con, which they're immediately able to tell because he has tattoos. He has no job opportunities open to him except for pretty much the worst jobs in Japan, which are being a caravan leader, the people who carry the palanquins, which is other people. They carry the palanquins that in which important people ride, which is a tremendously physically demanding job. Or they can become leather makers who have to work with the dead bodies of cattle. And in Japan at this time, which was primarily Buddhist, they didn't eat meat because Buddhist theology within Japan said you shouldn't eat animals that have four legs, you should only eat fish. And it's a reason why a lot of Japanese starved. They easily could have herded cattle and eaten a lot more protein in their diet, but they didn't because that was their religious practice. Shinto people did eat meat. And killing these cattle resulted in very bad karma. And working with the dead bad bodies of cattle to create leather, even though leather was very important, was also of something that someone with very, very low class, basically no class, did. And it wasn't very economical, wasn't high profit margin. And the other thing was to join a group of other ex-cons and continue murdering and stealing. That was really your option. The tattoos that they received, if they weren't immediately executed for their crimes, which they most often were, became kind of marks of, I have to join another clan, I have to join a clan of robbers and thieves, because they all have the same sort of tattoos, and then we'll get even more tattoos to hide our initial tattoos, to the point where they had like full body tattoos, like the whole body would be blue or other colors, mostly blue. And this has continued to this day in the form of the Yakuza having tattoos to signify that they are members of the Yakuza. It's also resulted in tattoos not being illegal in Japan, but being a sign of associated with criminal underworld, to the point where people who are upstanding citizens but have tattoos, have chosen to get tattoos, sometimes are prejudiced against. There was an interview on a Discovery Channel thing about Japanese tattoos with a guy who was a tattoo artist, and he said, "Yeah, I have a lot of tattoos because I'm really interested in body art, but sometimes when I go to a pool, a public pool or something like that, or a park, people tell me to get lost because I have tattoos, and they think that I must be some kind of criminal." So that actually continues through to today. Mugen doesn't have any additional tattoos, but then he has enough that people would instantly know who he is. So his life is really worthless in Japan, and he has to live on the outskirts of society for his whole life. Eventually he moves to the islands and he has a slightly better life, but he doesn't have any expectation that that's going to change. And he has no he's never had anyone in his life who has loved him unconditionally. He has had conditional love. He had a relationship with Miyoshi, who's dead, but it was a complex and on-off relationship with Miyoshi, and neither people were able to fully commit to the other person. He has a friendship with Brian and Noddy, but there is an understanding of social class there. As much as they try and treat him as an equal, the other people around him don't in England. And there is that undercurrent there that Noddy is a princess. Brian is married to a princess. He's an honorary prince and he's rich and he's the son of an earl. He belongs in England. He fits in. He is a social class above Mugen, way above Mugen. And you can't really totally escape that, especially in this time period. Mugen's kind of living off them, and they're treating him as an equal because they owe him their lives many, many, many times over. But it's not the same as someone looking up to him. And Georgie just looks up to him as like the greatest thing that has ever happened to her in her life and will ever happen to her. And he has never had that before and doesn't realize that he needs it until she comes along. And she looks up to him and she needs him in her life to kind of validate the things that she feels and wants to do. To the point where in book eight, she has to go looking for him, and he intentionally makes himself hard to find because he's kind of not willing to completely deal with how much that relationship is important to him. He's somebody who is really hard to pin down on what he actually believes, even though it's fairly obvious what he actually believes, but he won't actually admit it. 99% of the time, he won't actually admit what he believes. So, this is an incredibly important relationship, and I'm really happy to spend a story on it that does not involve, sort of anyone else. It does briefly involve her father, and it briefly involves Brian and Noddy, but for the most part, it's just the two of them in England going around doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And it happens to work out very well for both of them that day, in that Georgie gets to do a lot of things that she has never gotten to do and will probably never get to do again in England as a result of her being a woman. And Mugen gets to spend money and do things that he doesn't normally bother to do because he has this charge with him. He's in charge of her. And she kind of probes him into doing things that he wouldn't normally do. This is also, I want to point out, one of the reasons that I actually did enjoy part of writing this story is that this is the only segment that we have in the entire corpus of what I've written that is solely from his perspective, even if it is third person. And it's a Japanese-raised person who's lived either in Japan or China almost all of his life. And is living in England, and really everyone looks down on him as being this Chinaman. A lot of people get where he's from wrong. Most people don't know where Japan is or care or can tell the difference visually between him and Chinese people. It's asking a little much for people in Georgian England. But he looks down on them because he may be absolutely nothing in his culture, but at least he's Japanese. I mean, he has some national pride, and he has some pride in Asian culture. It was a cleaner culture. It had a lot less disease than Georgie in England, which was basically a cesspool. He smells a lot better. He eats healthier. He drinks less. He exercises more. I mean, he doesn't go out to do exercise, but he, in the things that he does, he gets a lot more exercise. He's generally healthier than the people who are around him. And culturally, that's very important to him. He really looks down on British people and Westerners in general. And it's not because he's a racist, though he is a little bit of a racist, because everyone is a little bit racist even today. But, back then it was even more prevalent. And the entire series is from the point of view of Westerners. And this is the only segment where it's from the point of view of someone who is from so far different a culture, looking down on the other culture. Everyone assumes that he kind of looks up to them as this extremely, Christian Anglo-Saxon Protestant superior people, and he very much the opposite. He really has very little regard for them, except for the people that he knows, and even then he's like, well, these people are silly. I don't know why they drink so much. I don't know why they never bathe. I mean, they did actually bathe, but not very often. I don't know why they don't keep themselves clean. I don't know why they drink such terrible tea. They just have no idea what is good in life. And they have all of these silly rules that don't make any sense. And they never take their shoes off. And when they do, they have really smelly feet. What's wrong with these people? And it goes beyond that. There's just this undercurrent that he has a different thinking of how things are supposed to be. That even though he lives outside the boundaries of his own society, he knows what his own society is and what he was raised with to some extent. He understands what you should have in your life, and they have very, very different values. And he sees no reason to accommodate himself to their values. He's just like, my way is totally better. I'd rather be clean and healthy and well-fed and also sleep around a lot more than you guys do because it's a lot more fun and there's no reason to have all of these sexual morals. They don't really get you anywhere. So, don't bother with them if you don't have to. I don't have to, so I'm not going to worry about it. I think in the series at some point, I don't know if this ever got cut. It's either in book 3 or book 4, Darcy makes some comment about when Mugen is in Derbyshire about all the whores in Lambton suddenly having Chinese babies or babies with slanted eyes. I don't remember how he actually put it, but the implication was there of Mugen is basically sleeping with every available prostitute in the area, and the area isn't very big, so this may result in some long-term damage to some effect. It never comes up again. Darcy kind of says it in passing. And he's not serious in any accusation, and he doesn't really care what Mugen does in his life. And no one really cares except Brian and Noddy, who are like, you better keep this from Georgie. You better not tell her what you're doing. And he pretty much does. That is like the only thing he never tells Georgie is Georgie knows to some extent. She doesn't really know at this point what sex is. She has ideas. And she knows that guys go to halls of prostitutes, but if you asked her what went on inside there, she wouldn't really be able to answer you. And Mugen doesn't enlighten her. And there are many points in this story where he has a chance to, and he's like, oh wait, no, I can't tell her this. Okay, she's still a little kid, she's the girl, and I'm not supposed to say these things to her, so I'm not going to. Some, measure of her honor I should probably preserve. So he has some respect. When it comes to Georgie, he just will obey boundaries that he normally won't obey because he wants to kind of do right by her. He knows that she just looks up to him and trusts him 100%, and he really does step up to the responsibility. Stepping up to the responsibility, obviously, a big theme in all of these stories of taking care of her and protecting her when it is necessary, both socially and physically, in terms of running away from various things that they've done, and also protecting her from the ills of society that she really shouldn't have any part in or see at her age and because of her gender. So I was really happy that the story got written. It was agonizing to write because I really wasn't in the mode to write it, and I wasn't in the mood to write it. And I was just supremely worried about sales, and I was busy with a lot of other things, but I did succeed in writing it, obviously, and I really hoped that everybody enjoyed it and enjoyed the other two stories. And it's a really unique story for the reasons that I've just listed. I hope you enjoyed all of the stories, and I hope that you will continue to read the series and that the stories will somehow enhance your appreciation of the series. And if you did buy it on Amazon, please know that most of that money went to me, and I make very little money on this series. I don't even want to calculate per hour what my wage must be. It's gotta be less than a couple dollars. So, thank you for your contribution.